Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, I'm Sam Van Hallgren. On this week's show, Adam and I devote this week's top five to our favorite actors and actresses in need of a career revival.
I think we can just call this one the John Travolta in Pulp Fiction Memorial List.
There you go,
Sam. Nice. We'll also have Massacre Theater, listener feedback, and music from National Beekeeper Society.
Plus, quick reviews of Will Ferrell in Blades of Glory and Joseph Gordon-Levitt in The Lookout, both opening this weekend. But we begin with the new critically lauded Korean monster movie, The Host.
Mr. Kim.
Formaldehyde. Dirty formaldehyde. Pour him into the sink.
And with that misguided order, Seol's Han River gives birth to the titular creature of Bong Joon-ho's breakout con hit, The Host. Sadly, the creature is never given a name, nor does Joon-ho imbue his multi-million-dollar monster with much of a personality, but there is a method to the director's madness. The disgusting, tentacled creature is merely a vessel, a device to help unite a dysfunctional family, which we see unfold after the monster, Sam, I'm going to call him Pokey.
Fine, good.
Drags a young girl, still alive, back to its dank sewer dwelling, prompting a rescue attempt by her dim-witted father, aunt, uncle, and grandfather. But the monster is also a tool for the Korean government, which uses fear to control its people by claiming the creature is the host of a deadly virus. Sam, I have no interest in generalizing about Asian cinema, but watching The Host on the heels of our recent animation marathon, which featured four prime examples of Japanese anime, had me in a near-constant state of déjà vu. Pollution leads to the formation of a gross, havoc-wreaking monster, just as we see in Miyazaki's Spirited Away. Certainly, Joon-ho's emphasis on the family also recalls Miyazaki. The socio-political commentary and government corruption is reminiscent of Akira and Ghost in the Shell. And finally, there's the hungry young boy who is captured by the monster and cared for by the older girl, both dreaming of the food they'll devour once they are rescued, the inverse of our tragic brother-sister team from Grave of the Fireflies. Were you making similar connections throughout The Host, and would you put the film on the same level as, say, Spirited Away with its mix of message and fantasy?
Well, yeah, it's like I'll never be able to watch a movie about starving orphans again without thinking of Grave of Fireflies.
I know, we're ruined, aren't we?
We're just ruined for it. Of course, there is a scene that I think it's impossible, once you've seen and been scarred by Grave of the Fireflies, to not think of the movie when you see this. These two boys, two young boys, scrounging for food, two orphans. But yeah, I certainly thought of it a lot. This young sort of preteen heroine battling a monster, absolutely. The monster that's created by pollution, the U.S. Army, pouring formaldehyde down the drain, poisoning the Han River. Absolutely. I thought of our anime marathon all the time. But I think more in general, how I handled this movie was just as a genre movie, mm-hmm. which I think admittedly, Adam, you and I are not really well-versed in genre movies in general. I think specifically here, monster movies, the progenitor being Godzilla. I mean, you can't think of like a mutant monster and not think of Godzilla here. And I think with genre movies in general, I was thinking that I love when a genre movie like The Host is critically praised, because otherwise I personally am probably not going to go out of my way to catch it. But I love the idea of being surprised by something new and seeing mm-hmm. something new and seeing a genre sort of reinvigorated by new ideas. And I love that. So I was really excited to see The Host, maybe more so than other films. I was a little worried by the poster. You know, I hadn't seen a trailer, and I was excited about visiting this genre, but the poster with like the tentacled arm of the creature
mm-hmm.
stretching out of the Han River, grasping this child, all I saw was CGI monster. That's what I felt all of a sudden like what I was going to see. So I had battled fears and excitements really with this film, and ultimately I think my fears won out. I was not really won over by this movie, and I know it had more going on. It wasn't just a monster movie. It has a lot of ideas it's playing with,
sure.
In terms of like mob mentality and the whole fear of SARS and the bird flu over there, and certainly Korea's fraught relationship with the United States. I know a lot of that's going on there, and I felt like either I didn't get it and was bored by it, or I did get it and was still kind of bored by
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat as you, actually, feeling by the end of it a little bit underwhelmed, and we'll get into some of those reasons. But I think I do give the film and Junho a little more credit than you do. I actually was really surprised by that opening scene where we played part of it there in the clip, and you referenced it, the U.S. doctor, the army pouring formaldehyde down the drain and causing the birth of this monster. And it's a scene that feels lifted right out of the opening scene of David Cronenberg's A History of Violence. It has that same awkwardness to it, that just nothing about it feels natural, and there's some suspense to it just in the way the actors are talking, and it immediately made me realize, okay, this is a movie that's going to be a little bit messed up. It's going to be unreal. We're going to be entering this heightened universe. And so after that setup, I was willing to go with the film a little bit. And I think that Junho is really taking a chance with the way he is mixing a lot of these genres. I think the scene that probably will get the most play among critics or anybody who sees the film, the most memorable scene, is the scene where the family is grieving the loss of their daughter. She's just been carried away by this monster. They're sure she's dead. Yeah. And they're at this vigil. They've been displaced. They're with all these other people. And there's this wall with the faces of these people who are lost. And they're all grieving. And it turns into actually a grief competition. They start trying to outcry each other. And they end up actually writhing on the floor in their grief. And it becomes comical. And I was watching it feeling like it's a scene where you can't help but laugh. And yet you don't want to laugh because it's so depressing, and it becomes a moment that for me felt like it would have been right at home in Borat. You know, it's so over the top and obviously intended to cause discomfort. And so for me, you know, to answer my question, though, going back to what I posed to you, I can't put it up there with a film like Spirited Away. I think it's a little too sprawling and slapstick for me in terms of its comedy. But the way Junho is able to really make a compelling mishmash of B-level monster movie with comedy that's both dark and slapstick, and a family drama, and a political commentary, and it's a paranoid thriller, like something like The Parallax View. I think he mixed that all together in a way that could have just been an absolute disaster, and instead it ended up working for me on the whole.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it's a disaster at all. I totally appreciate what you're saying, and I think I even agree. I'm glad you pointed that out in terms of that first scene, because I did like that first scene, and I did like the kind of heightened quality that he gives the film. The first couple scenes are wonderful, actually, because the scene that follows that, the scene with the in the sort of U.S. Army base morgue where they pour the formaldehyde down the sink, we get this wonderful scene of two fishermen in the Han River who get the first sight of the creature. The creature at its sort of embryonic stage. We never see it. It's from a distance. The fishermen try to capture it in a little cup, and then it escapes. And I was like, oh gosh, I really hope the movie is more like this. We never, ever see the creature. We just see people respond to it. The fact is, the next time we see the creature is how we see him for the rest of the film in full body pose, and he's wreaking havoc. And I, getting back to what you said about the kind of absurdist tragedy, I think that might be the only way to describe it. It's the kind of thing, like you're saying, in terms of its depiction of the kind of hysteria caused by this virus, you know, that may or may not even exist. I appreciated all of that in terms of the paranoid thriller element, this absurdist tragedy element. But I felt like none of it really clicked. I did appreciate that fact. And it was moments like that where that discomfort of, is this supposed to be funny? Is this supposed to be tragic? Or is it just a commentary on how the media handles grief?
Sure.
It's all of those things. And yet none of it really paid off emotionally for me. And then the family, like you said, this is this dysfunctional family made up of this grandfather and dim-witted son and granddaughter and then the brother and sister. To me, and you'll know this is a criticism because of the example I used, it felt like watching a monster movie starring the cast of Little Miss Sunshine. Mm-hmm. This was an unpleasant group to spend any time with for me. They've all got their problems and they rise above them. Yes, they do. And we know they're going to, but boy, they're just so uninspiring.
Yeah, but, you know, I thought they fit perfectly into the idea of the genre, the B-movie genre, in that all the characters have their own traits and strengths and weaknesses. They almost become kind of like comic book characters, and I don't want to generalize about comic books and make the same mistake I did with video games with 300, Sam. But you know what I mean. They all have kind of a skill that I think is interesting about them, and I think that that does fit into the genre mixing and matching that's going on here. But I do agree with you. I really do. I mean, I think I just liked it a little more than you. But by the end of it, if you break down its parts, yes, it has some smart social and political commentary, but not enough to really say to someone, you have to go see this movie for its brilliant take on the U.S. and Korea and its politics. It doesn't have enough truly funny moments, even though there is a lot of comedy. And then there isn't a lot of truly suspenseful moments, at least not for me. Yes, some of those scenes are there, some of the monster action movie type stuff you'd expect, but there isn't enough that by the end of it, you really feel like it adds up to a whole lot. That said, I do feel like some of that satire alone is worth recommending it. And, you know, there is that great sense that Junho brings to it that this creature, the way we first see it after that scene you mentioned, where he's just hanging from the bridge and the way the people are all admiring it and they think it's like this great creature you might see in a zoo. There's this clear sense the director is saying, like, you know, we created this. This really is a creature that is an embodiment of a country's problems, of the world's problems. And the people, you know, there is that satire of how they love looking at it, like I said, until it comes to devour them. And I also thought there was a fantastic scene right after that scene that I mentioned, the grieving scene where they've all been displaced and they're in this kind of gymnasium. And this government official comes in and starts barking orders and asking questions. And everyone's just going along with it until someone finally decides to actually ask the obvious question, point out something that doesn't quite make sense. And then all of a sudden, you mentioned mob mentality, everything is up for grabs. And then it follows that with them saying, we need a report. Tell us the official report of what's going on. And the guy actually goes to turn on the news,
right,
which is just, you know, a great comment on the fact that, like, we're actually just going to let the news be our mouthpiece blatantly. There's no denying that they're literally just spouting kind of our press releases there. So some of those things are great. And I think, too, the visual touches of the film, he withholds a lot of great information. You think a character has done something or escaped a certain way, and then we see the monsters got a hold of him. And the scene, did you think about that scene? Did it strike a chord with you where the family is sitting around and you talked about how maybe they were kind of like Little Miss Sunshine, you didn't enjoy spending time with them, but the scene where they all sit down to have dinner and Junho puts the little girl in the scene with them, and it could have been so manipulative, and maybe some people think it is, but they're all eating, and I loved it because it becomes this physical embodiment of what you know is going on psychologically and emotionally. They're all thinking about the fact how we're sitting down to a family dinner and eating this nice food, or as nice as it can be, and she's starving, and we need to find her. And so they're all in their heads giving her food. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, and it really is a combination of their emotional inner lives and her desires, like her fantasy.
Sure.
Because I think that next scene we go to her. No, it's a nice scene, and I think I don't want to you know, take anything away from the really nice scenes that are, you know, are pocketed throughout this film. Ultimately, though, it just didn't work for me, and maybe my expectations were a little too high.
Maybe so. If you've seen The Host and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, I do a little shake and bake with Will Ferrell and John Hader in Blades of Glory, and Adam will share his thoughts on writer-director Scott Frank's The Lookout. Stay with us.
What's that one with the horse?
My blonde Ukrainian she-devil.
Not Oksana Bayul. At 16, she won the gold, turned pro, and was named one of Barbara Walters' most fascinating persons of 1994.
But don't let her fool you. She's as cold as the ice she skates on. She's like dry ice. Wait, she's colder than that. What's colder than dry ice?
I don't know.
I'll tell you what is. Oksana.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. That's Will Ferrell and John Hader in a scene from Blades of Glory, the new figure skating comedy out this weekend. And Sam, we're doing something here that we never do. Yeah. We've done it maybe once before in the history of film spotting, but we're violating our own personal rules here, where we don't like to talk about movies with each other before the other person has seen it, before we've even discussed them on air. We like there to be some surprise. But with these two new movies that are out this weekend, we've got Blades of Glory and also The Lookout. It just so happens that you were able to get to an advanced screening of Blades of Glory this week, and I was not. While I was obviously able to get to a screening of The Lookout, I interviewed Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good and Scott Frank on last week's show, and you haven't yet had a chance to see it. So we are, in the interest of being timely for our audience, going to share some of our thoughts here individually on these films. So Blades of Glory, you even mentioned, I think, last week on the show that as much as we love Will Ferrell, you had even more interest and desire to see Kicking and Screaming, that soccer yes. movie that you couldn't even remember the name of, than this film. For some reason, the shine has started to come off our boy Will Ferrell a little bit. And we usually have a lot of expectations going into films of his, like we did with Talladega Nights. Here, we really had low expectations. So how did it come out with Blades of Glory, Sam?
Not so well, Adam.
Really?
This movie, I apologize in advance for my hyperbole, because here it comes. This movie isn't just bad, and it is bad. In fact, it's awful. I think this movie is actually dangerous.
Really?
And let me explain why. I think it's dangerous to the actors in the film. And if I were the actors, I would have, having seen the final cut of this movie, I would have pooled their money together and kept this film from being released. It's that bad to me. And the reason is because I think it's dangerous, because I think it will infect how at least I perceive these actors' other work, because I think the film was almost entirely undirected. It may have been blocked, but what I saw in all of these performances is what these actors, all very good actors. Let me just go through the list really quickly here. You know, you've got great William Fichtner, great character actor, Will Arnett, Amy Poehler, Jenna Fischer, Craig T. Nelson, Will Ferrell, of course. All really good comic actors, who have been good elsewhere many, many times. In fact, many of these people have never been bad. And in this film, what you see is their crutches. You see what they bring when they show up on the set, you know, and being undirected as they seem to be in this. It's just, or it's like they were like, oh, did you get through that line without stumbling? Cut and print. Let's do it. I didn't laugh once at this film, and that's really sad. I may have chuckled once or twice at something Will Ferrell was doing. And again, this is the kind of Ferrell performance where I understood what people mean when they say they don't like Will Ferrell. This is the kind of movie I think everyone else has been watching. Meanwhile, I've been watching Old School and Anchorman and Talladega Nights, and I've been amused by them. They've been watching this movie where it's totally recycled, phoned in variations of an amalgam of Ferrell performances. It is touches of Anchorman and a little bit of Talladega Nights, but it's nothing specific. There's nothing specific about any of these characters. And you notice I went through that long list of really good character actors that are in this film. And note, I did not mention
the co-star,
John Hader.
Yeah.
The co-star, John Hader, who I've only seen, admittedly, only seen in Napoleon Dynamite. And I feel bad for judging him on the performance in this film, which admittedly is a bad script, a bad film, bad direction, bad everything. And I'm just going to read a quick email from our dope sheet editor, Jeff Houston, who tries to pinpoint why I wasn't really looking forward to this film. He writes, "I think I know why. Despite all the hilarious Will Ferrell clips in the trailers and ads, why you're still nonplussed about Blades of Glory. I just realized it the other night, and it can be explained in two words. John Hader. I'm laughing at every preview and commercial until he pops up. It instantly stops any comic momentum, and understandably, the most recent ads have focused on Ferrell's Chaz Michael Michaels." What a name, Jeff writes. "Hopefully the film will focus mostly on him, too, because outside of Napoleon Dynamite, I don't think Hader's got the goods at all." And he doesn't. I wonder if maybe Hader showed up with a character, and it just wasn't working at all, and they're like, just be yourself, John. And he's just, it's not funny at all. Like, nothing he does even shows any comic potential.
Yeah.
I don't want to go into this. I'm going to let you actually get to The Lookout, Adam. But really, this film was painful. And I don't think we put ourselves in the way of many bad comedies. I mean, we don't see a lot of comedies maybe on this show anyway. So maybe it's unfair to compare it to other films we've seen. But it just seems so lazy, so slapped together, so painfully unfunny that maybe it, I'm not sure if it deserves the hyperbole, but it's certainly getting it.
So our worst fears were realized, and not only that, they seemed to be exceeded.
They were exceeded. And yeah, my fears. And I think it had something to do with the fact that, well, it makes me think that my intuition is working, you know, with Will mm-hmm. Ferrell. It isn't just Will Ferrell. It is the right project, and this clearly wasn't it. But moving on, last week, as we said, you got a chance to talk to the director, writer-director Scott Frank of The Lookout and a couple of the co-stars, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Matthew Good. And this film, which we've talked about, is about this once-promising athlete played by Gordon-Levitt who becomes physically and mentally handicapped after this car crash, and then he gets caught up in this planned heist of the bank he's working at. And Adam, when you talked to these guys last week, it sure sounded like you liked the film. Were you just making that up, or did you actually like it?
No, I'm an incredible phony, really. I can pull that off. I mean, haven't you heard my great acting on Massacre Theater,
these
shows here, Sam? But no, I really did like the film, and it is a movie that I think gets better the more time you spend away from it. Things really started to connect for me after seeing the movie and really planted themselves in my brain about the things I liked about it in the day or two that followed, and it is most of the things I asked them about during the interview. First of all, Gordon-Levitt's understated performance. He's an actor we both like a lot, as we've said, from Mysterious Skin, from Brick. And I think, as I asked him about his approach, he could have easily played Chris Pratt as a character who is truly handicapped after suffering this head injury. Really made him someone who's slow, a Rain Man-like character, mm-hmm. instead of someone who's just slightly off, who goes through the same routines we go through on a daily basis, but just has to struggle a little bit more than most of us. And I loved that, and I also loved how he is this anti-noir character. He's always a step behind the audience instead of a step ahead. The writing, too, I asked Scott Frank about his Elmore Leonard influence, and there are scenes with Levitt and Matthew Good in this scene, and also with Levitt and Jeff Daniels, who plays his blind roommate and basically his caretaker, Lewis. He's fantastic. And those guys, just in some of their dialogue scenes, there is a crackle to it that you just have fun listening to, just like when you watch Out of Sight or Get Shorty. And the other thing I mentioned in asking Scott Frank was how straight he played it. I kept expecting with this crime movie there to be some big twist reveal at the end, and actually the ending I think suffers a little bit from being a little bit too syrupy, considering the edge it has otherwise. There's maybe a little bit of a letdown, but there is no big twist, there's no manipulation. That said, what keeps me from using a word like masterpiece, like I heard Richard Roper use on Ebert and Roper last weekend, is three things, and I'll mention them here as quickly as I can and just say that they're all minor. Two of them, the first two, are almost insignificant, but worth mentioning. Obviously, they did stand out for me a little bit. Is one, Frank commits for me one of the ultimate screenwriting sins, in that he creates a character who literally serves no other purpose in the story but to die. He is the textbook I'm going to die character, and he is manipulative in a film that otherwise isn't that way, because if you've ever seen any crime film, when this guy walks on screen, you know exactly what's going to happen to him. That really bugs me. It's a pet peeve of mine. And the end of the film then, in it being a little bit syrupy, ends up being cynical because of the way that character is handled. And I don't want to give away any more until people see it, but that is a case for me where I just couldn't believe that Scott Frank did that. I almost want to say that he's trying to comment on the genre in a way, because it's such a blatant sin in my book, a screenwriting sin. I also had the sense throughout that Scott Frank was maybe a little bit too clever. The writing's great, it's a clever script, but when I asked him about the narrative device of storytelling, how the movie is kind of about storytelling, and he had a great response where he talked about how Chris Pratt orders his life the same way, you see this very clearly in the film, the same way you can order a movie or any kind of narrative with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So there's this juicy meta-level stuff going on that you can see a screenwriter really enjoying and playing with. And by the time the movie gets over, though, I really felt that hand at work. I felt like the screenwriter was really enjoying what he was doing. It just was a little too clever for me, maybe. Again, minor things. The big thing for me, though, was just that Isla Fisher, I think I'm saying her name right, she's the girl that Vince Vaughn falls in love with in Wedding Crashers. She's the quasi femme fatale, and by the end of it, her true motivations and her feelings are never fleshed out for me in a satisfying way, to the point where I'm almost positive there are a lot of scenes with her on the cutting room floor. There was a lot more to the script that they just cut out for time or whatever to pick up the pace of the film a little bit, keep it more like a crime film. But I know there are scenes that we see that just don't feel right, that you feel like you missed a scene right before it that would have made this scene make perfect sense. I really feel like that entire storyline was gutted in a way. And I could be wrong. I haven't read the original script or I don't know what form it was in, but that's my sense watching it, and I'm very curious if some of our other listeners who see it this weekend had a sense I did. So again, I can't use the word masterpiece like Roper did, but certainly a film I recommend for everyone to check out.
And of course, I wasn't listening to anything you were saying, Adam. I totally tuned out. I want to go into this movie fresh.
Okay.
All right. Well, if you've seen The Lookout or Blades of Glory, and I'm telling you, please do not. Don't do it. Don't do it. Not for me. And you want to chime in, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater and the secret to hacking into the government's mainframe and making sexy women. Listener feedback is next. Stay with us. I wish I was cool, so I could sign my revolution. Like bumper stickers are cool. That's how I learned about evolution. Superman, what's he selling? I don't know, but everybody's buying.
Our problem is take the bank or split right now. Do not go home. Do not pack. Nothing. 30 seconds flat from now, we are gone on our separate ways. That's it. Chris.
The bank is worth the risk. I need it, brother. You should stay and take it down. That's where I come out.
I roll with you, Neil. Whatever.
No, not on this one, Michael. On this one, you're on your own.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay and you get a shot at a free DVD. Last week, Adam and a couple of special guests from the movie The Lookout massacred the scene you just heard from Michael Mann's Heat, a tie-in with The Lookout, another heist caper.
That's right. That was Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing the Robert De Niro role. I'm sure everyone picked out the perfect imitation there, right?
Oh, it was uncanny.
Scott Frank was playing the Tom Sizemore role, and I had my one line as Val Kilmer. I've always wanted to say, I need it, brother, and I got my chance to say it,
shot.
Sam. But you know what they say, too? I only had one line, but it's not how big the part is. It's how big the performance is. And I think I pulled it off.
You absolutely did. And in fact, I want Film Spotting listeners to remember that fact. Later in our top five, I'm going to mention that fact, a memorable one-line performance.
All right.
All right. Well, Adam, reach into that Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Tariq Abdel Monem from Lincoln, Nebraska. Congratulations, Tariq. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
This week's edition of Massacre Theater, of course, ties in with our top five we will get to in the next segment. That is top five actors and actresses, Sam, that we think are most in need of a career revival, a career boost.
That's right. Maybe they're
not getting enough parts, or maybe they're simply not getting enough good parts.
Sure.
We will discuss that later on in the show. So this ties in directly with that. And Sam, it is a small scene, but a very memorable one. So we don't think it'll be too difficult. And you started off, so I'll give you the action. And action.
Take that to the press.
I might have a little trouble with that. Some people think you're as dangerous as blank.
He's psychotic.
Some people say the same thing about you.
What people?
Well, let's face it, you're not exactly normal, are you?
And scene. Yeah, and if that actor was as bad as I was in that scene portraying him, it'd be no wonder that he wasn't getting any roles anymore.
That is true, unfortunately. But if you know what film we just massacred, send us an email by Wednesday, April 4th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net.
Hey, Adam and Sam. This is Brent from Northern California. I really enjoyed your show about your top five movies about friends, and I pretty much nailed all of mine, so I always get excited when you guys think the same thing about what I think about a movie. I wonder if you guys considered Heartache, or if you just forgot about it. I think that's a really good movie about two guys being really good friends.
Hey guys, this is Mark calling back from Dallas, Texas. I just wanted to kind of respond on to your top five films about friendship or male bonding. A couple that I wanted to add, one is Rounders with Matt Damon and Edward Norton, a very underrated movie from a few years ago. It kind of predated the poker craze, but again, it's one of those situations where you have the friend that you love, that you're loyal to, but is also the albatross around your neck. Very well done. And to me, the ultimate movie about friendship is the movie that devastated me as a six-year-old, and that's Steven Spielberg's E.T. One of the first movie I ever saw in a theater, and it just destroyed me, and I think it's one of his very best films. So,
a couple voicemails there from Brent in Northern California and also Mark in Dallas. Brent had a great choice there. Hard Eight, of course,
yeah.
Sydney, the Philip Baker Hall character, befriending John C. Reilly's John. And I think that Sydney even has a line. What's that line from the film? It's always good to meet a new friend. So
that's right.
Definitely a great choice. And Mark in Dallas, Rounders. I did think about Rounders because I like that movie. It was pre-poker craze. Ed Norton, of course, and also Matt Damon. And Ed Norton is, as Mark said, that friend who ties in with some of the friends we had on our list, the dangerous friend, the wild friend, the friend that you need to get away from in order to just stay alive, basically. So a great choice there. And E.T., Sam, how do we
yeah.
leave off E.T.?
You leave it off because, you know, there are only so many opportunities. In film spotting, we need to give ourselves a reason to cry, really, to mist
That's
up,
true.
To get dusty in the room, right?
And it's funny, too, because Mark mentioned he sounded a lot like me in terms of his reminiscing about that film. I think it was the first film I really remember seeing in the theater, and we went over that nostalgia list once on the show. It was a lot of fun to go down memory lane, E.T., classic friendship movie. And we've got some great emails here with some other classic friendship movies that didn't make our list. Why don't you kick it off, Sam, with Josiah Johnson, not to be confused with Robert Redford's Jeremiah Johnson.
That's right. Josiah Johnson, writing from Aurora, Illinois. His top five movies about friendship. He's got Altman's California Split, Louis Malle's Au Revoir Les Enfants. Then he's got, great pick, and in my penalty box, Adam, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest. He writes, as much praise as Nicholson received for his Devil May Care performance, Cuckoo's Nest doesn't truly resonate without the stoic presence of his emotional counterpart, Will Sampson's Chief Bromden, who delivers the film's final haunting blow. It's a great point. He's also got Scorsese's Mean Streets on here. And number one, and probably, Adam, we should have named our top five friendship list the honorary Jules and Jim friendship list.
Yes, we should have. In fact, I did. I can honestly tell you that I had it at the top of my page of notes, managed to forget it while doing the show, but a great choice here from Josiah, who says that though it has as much to do with the subjectification of women, Jules and Jim is nonetheless the most perfectly realized film about male friendship, showing how it grows and adapts in the face of maturity, war, love, and diverging styles. Though it has been oft imitated, most recently by E2 Mama Tambien, which did make my list, it mm-hmm. will never be equaled. A great point there from
point.
Josiah. And Sam, we get on now to Aaron Appalling Sunrise in Albany, who's got as his number five film, it was referenced there in the tease coming into this segment, Weird Science.
That's right.
Gary and Wyatt had it all. At age 11, my friend and I tried to jam stuff into my Commodore 64's floppy drive. This was apparently how you hacked into the government's mainframe and made a sexy woman. I have a confession here, Sam. Don't think me and my best friend Matt, when we were that age,
didn't try
to have our mom, who was a pretty good computer person on our old Apple IIe, somehow design a program similar to what was going on in Weird Science. I mean, we did the exact same thing. And another confession, I still to this day have a friend from high school, my best friend Jason, who we actually call each other Gary and Wyatt still to this day. That's how much we loved Weird Science. And everyone listening can imagine which one of us is Wyatt. I'll go ahead and let the listeners use their imagination about that one. He's also got Tenacious D in The Pick of Destiny. Number three, Toy Story. I can't picture Buzz without Woody. With three kids, I've seen it at least 300 times. I have two. It obviously almost made my list. A great choice. You've got a friend in me. It comes to mind immediately. And this film, Sam, is one that Aaron had on his list, and at least one other listener wrote in chiding you for leaving it off. That's Half Nelson. There's a profoundly intimate and honest quality to the friendship between Dan Dunn and Dre. Gosling and Epps are both wonderful, and Aaron admits he wouldn't have seen it if it were not for film spotting. And number one, Aaron is also on the E.T. bandwagon. Can't blame him a bit. And that ties in also, real quick, Sam, with Jason Wiltz in St. Paul, Minnesota, who the minute he started thinking about this friendship list, he started thinking of The Breakfast Club, naturally, and then he started thinking of Weird Science and Ferris Bueller's Day Off and realized that basically any John Hughes film could be on the list, and that's absolutely true.
No, and just getting back to Aaron's quickly, I certainly thought of Half Nelson, and I almost feel bad not for putting it on because it would have been an example of a male-female relationship that absolutely would have fit on our list that didn't become romantic in some way, which is why I sort of eliminate it from my criteria. But it's a really good pick, and Toy Story, our good friend Matt Singer, who pointed out really you could put any of the Pixar pictures really in a top five list, not just Toy Story.
Absolutely.
But, it's a great pick. All right, well, quickly, let's stay in the nostalgic realm here. Brian Parkhurst, writing from Cincinnati, Ohio, writes, "Hey, Adam and Sam, first let me say that both of you had damn good lists for the top five movies about friendship, but how could you leave out The Outsiders? Pony Boy and Johnny Cake are my ideal image for best friends. I think both of you need to revisit it and reconsider your lists. Thanks for the great podcast, Brian in Cincinnati, Ohio." Adam?
Yeah, Brian is absolutely right, and I definitely considered it. Left off, as I said during the show, I'm almost positive The Outsiders was on my male bonding top five, and I did try to eliminate as much overlap as possible. Otherwise, you're right. You think about Ralph Macchio, C. Thomas Howell from that film. Absolutely a great movie about friendship, a good choice there. Which brings us to our last email here, Sam, about friendship. We wanted to share this one from Marianne Bacharach in Oklahoma City, because we did bring up this concept of female friendships in films, and I had Heavenly Creatures, which is going to violate a rule you're going to hear that Marianne puts forth in her email, but it is true how hard it is to find good movies about female friendships. And she writes in and says that she wasn't surprised that our lists were so male-centric, not because we're men, but because there just aren't very many movies about female friendships, and movies in which the girls become lovers don't count. You might as well have listed Brokeback Mountain. Confession, another one, I almost considered Brokeback Mountain.
Sure, sure.
I did. She writes, "I challenge you to come up with a list of 10 good movies about female friendship / female bonding that don't revolve around either men or lesbianism. I'll even let you let the movies revolve around having children. I'll bet you can't do it. I remember hearing that Thelma and Louise was the female road movie, or the female Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but was terribly disappointed that it, like so many other female movies, was primarily about their dysfunctional relationships with men." She goes on to say that what kills her about the fact that Hollywood can't seem to come up with any good ideas is that she admits that she's a 39-year-old, happily married, part-time doctor, mother of one with one on the way, wishing she could write movies, and even she can't think up good female bonding, female friendship movie ideas about women like her. Again, that from Marianne in Oklahoma City. And she's put forth a nice challenge here to us and our listeners. I think we've already answered the fact that we can't meet the challenge. That was our top five last week. We couldn't do it. Maybe some of our listeners can, Sam.
I certainly hope so. Yeah, I tried to respond to her challenge immediately and sort of went to IMDb, and I was like, I know there have got to be at least five obvious picks here. And the fact is, the best I could do was like A League of Their Own. And she's right to point out that, you know, there probably are a lot of films that depict in some way that those female friendships, but usually they're couched within these films that are about women's relationships with men, these romantic comedies and so on.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, let's get on to some battle scenes feedback. We're not going to be able to get to it all here in this segment or on this show, but there certainly was a common theme that came up in the feedback, the responses to our top five battle scenes from a couple weeks ago. Why don't you read this one here, Sam, from Ryan Yates?
Yeah, Ryan, writing from Missoula, Montana, writes, "Battle scenes and no mention of Kurosawa. He has Ron, of course, haunting and beautiful. We watch as Lord Hidetora witnesses the same kind of destruction that he's been responsible for all his life. And then, of course, Seven Samurai. Adam mentioned how Ridley Scott constantly reorients us in Black Hawk Down. Kurosawa uses the whole film of Seven Samurai to give context and perspective to the battle scene at the end. He uses distinctive visual features to let you know that you are looking at a new perspective without being too overt about it. Perhaps it wasn't on your list, Sam, because it requires the whole film to set it up. It couldn't be considered a scene, or maybe it was because you haven't seen it." Ryan challenges me, which, of course, came up in our most embarrassed list a couple weeks ago. I have since remedied that, Ryan Yates and Film Spotting listeners. And, of course, the battle scene that really makes up nearly the last hour of Seven Samurai is pretty magnificent filmmaking and probably would have made my list after I had seen it. Ryan also has on here Andrei Rublev, Saving Private Ryan, and, of course, Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, and that was the common thread there. Kurosawa, Brent Harris in Greensboro, North Carolina, wrote in about him. Joran Kane in Valdosta, Georgia, wrote in and said, "Okay, Sam hasn't seen Seven Samurai at the time, but have neither of you seen Ron or Throne of Blood? We have. Yep. He wants to know, are any other Kurosawa films? Come on, you guys. Americans aren't the only ones who can stage great battle scenes." He mentions Lord Hidetora. vividly recalling the scene where his entire army has just been wiped out, his castle's in flames, and he's clearly descending into madness as he leaves his castle, arrows flying back and forth behind him. It's great stuff. It is great stuff. Ron has two fantastic battle scenes. Throne of Blood is fantastic. They easily could have made the list. And Jorn also had a good one here, Sam, with Children of Men,
yeah,
his favorite movie from last year. From a technical standpoint, that final battle scene is truly amazing, obviously, but when you throw in the stakes that are involved, saving all of mankind, as well as the great use of Penderecki, I hope I'm saying that right, in the soundtrack, that scene rises above anything else in recent memory. Jorn's also going to go check out Master and Commander soon on our recommendation, so that's nice to hear. But again, Brett Merriman wrote in as well, mentioning whether it's Seven Samurai or Ron or Throne of Blood, those are great battle
sure
scenes. We completely agree. We left them off. I think I mentioned that part of the problem, Sam, is that I thought about a lot of older films like that, but those scenes just weren't as vivid in my memory as
right
obviously the scenes that were newer, or in the case of Apocalypse Now, which I've seen many times. But I threw in Ron just the other day to revisit some of those battle scenes, and if I had done that, just
yeah
like you, if I had done that before
right
we had made our list, I think Ron without a doubt would have made my list. So we appreciate everyone sending in the feedback and letting us know that we need to keep Kurosawa at the top of our minds. And again, great feedback all the way around. We'll get to some more battle scenes hopefully on the next show. But if you've got feedback for us, as always, you can send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
We're going to take another quick break. When we return, Adam and I perform CPR on the careers of some of our favorite actors. Stay with us. Time to take a look at what's new on DVD, courtesy of PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
Coming out this Tuesday, it's a quiet week for new stuff, but there is one notable new release, Sam. If you sign up for a free PureFlix account now at PureFlix.com/filmspotting, or click the link on the filmspotting.net site, you'll be entered to win Pedro Almodovar's Volver,
yeah,
of course with a great performance from Penelope Cruz, in a film we both love, Sam.
Yeah, we really did.
All right, so you can check that one out, sign up for a PureFlix account, and get a shot at winning that. We'll announce the winner on next week's show. Also coming out, Anchor Bay's Mario Bava Collection, Volume 1, and I mentioned that because I know we got a lot of horror movie fans out there, specifically Italian horror. Also, All That Jazz, the music edition. You know, Sam, I'm a huge fan of the Bob Fosse film, All That Jazz,
uh-huh,
so it's kind of nice to see that film get a bigger DVD release. And at long last,
yes,
this is really what everyone should be rejoicing about, the second season of Twin Peaks out this Tuesday. All 22 episodes that close out the series. If you didn't watch Twin Peaks when it was on, or if you haven't caught up with the series on VHS, as I did, you can now watch the entire series on DVD. Start watching it. You will not be able to stop, Sam, I assure you.
I know. That's why I'm not going to start just yet. All right, we want to thank a few people that went to filmspotting.net and donated a little bit of their money by clicking on the PayPal link. They are care of Jonathan Hennessy, Annie, the Bel Air, Belladonna, Olschlager. Thank you, Jonathan, for the donation, and thank you, Annie, for listening. We also have donations from Elizabeth, The Final Intelligence, Christian, False Sense of Insecurity, and Bruce, Interplanetary Incident. Thank you. You can get your patented Sam Van Holger nickname by going to filmspotting.net and clicking on that PayPal link.
I think we should help Mozart all we can. And do our best to protect him against the Emperor's anger.
What anger?
About the ballet.
What ballet?
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that was a clip from Amadeus, Best Actor winner,
yeah,
F. Murray Abraham. Why are we playing a clip from Amadeus? Well, of course, our top five list, actors in need of a career revival. And certainly, Sam, I think F. Murray Abraham has to be the poster boy. I'm actually calling my list, I think yours might qualify as well, as the F. Murray Abraham Where Have You Gone list.
Sure, fair enough. But I mean, I happen to know where he is. He's actually doing a season on Broadway of two Shylock characters. I just want to give a shout out to my boy F. Murray, who's keeping it real in theater. So
he certainly is. If you look at his filmography, though, it's really bleak over the past 20 years or so. So anyway, we're gonna get to some more of our favorite actors who really need some help with their careers, or at least we think they need some help. We'll get to that later in this segment, but we did want to take a few minutes just to go over some quick notes, including a couple brief corrections, starting with last week's show. We talked about Mike Binder's new film, Over Me, with Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle. We did spend the entire review calling him Mike Binder. I had not heard his name ever pronounced until
I don't think I had
after.
Either.
Yeah, until after we had recorded, Sam, and it is, in fact, Mike Binder, so we apologize to Mike and anyone else out there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Sam, you had a nice confession in this week's edition of The Dope Sheet,
yes.
And actually, I'll read real quick. Here he is again. How does Jose from Portugal get in every show these days,
Oh, he's amazing.
I don't
El Deuterino. Let's just call him El Deuterino. Yeah.
From Lisbon, he's claiming now, and he says that I have nothing to say about Rain Over Me because I haven't seen it. But I found it interesting that you made it seem like this was Binder's first movie after The Upside of Anger. Did you make a conscious effort to leave that Ben Affleck POS that came out last year out of the discussion, or weren't you even aware it existed? Again, if you want to hear Sam's complete explanation on this, check out the dope sheet if you don't already get it. I'll put a link in the notes for this show. But Sam, just real quick, do you want to explain? I thought you did it again very eloquently. Do you want to just take a minute to explain your Mike Binder mistake last week on the show?
Yeah, I mean, and I think I actually went the entire show without calling Rain Over Me his sophomore effort, or referring to The Upside of Anger as his debut or anything like that. In the show notes, I think I did, and those have been since corrected too, I think, call it that. But I think how it comes across that I was treating it as his second film was a sort of condescending attitude of comparing him to, like, friends of mine who have staged their own work in storefront theaters in Chicago or something, which I think was my way of saying, like, I know you're a young writer, Mike Binder, but the fact is, usually I always, before I see a film, before we review it, certainly, I go to IMDb and I check, you know, their filmography, and I didn't in this case because I just thought I knew. I knew Binder was this long-term character actor, TV and film, and I knew he had. I knew he had created The Mind of a Married Man for HBO, and then, well, I thought that his debut film was Upside of Anger. Mm-hmm. I just assumed, and I do apologize for that, and that does explain why I treated him as a second time writer director.
And of course, listeners out there are wondering right now how you could have forgot The Immortal Indian Summer and Blank Man, but that's
right.
Fine. We will move on. Another note related to our marathons. Of course, you've noticed the last 2 weeks we haven't got to the third film in our silent films marathon. We will be back on track next week with Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin.
Yeah.
And another note, if you're looking ahead to the next marathon, Sam, we got a great email this week from Amelia, who is not alone. She's one of many people who wrote in and said, we really need to do a film noir marathon. And she provided some links to some recent Vanity Fair articles on the best noirs ever, and then like the 10 best overlooked noir films. And we have already said that we were going to do a Romare/Bresson marathon next, but we've come to an agreement here that we think we need a sexier marathon. We're going to put Romare and Bresson off, and we are going to get to film noir next.
Yeah.
But we are going to try to do films that are maybe more of the overlooked noir. That doesn't mean we won't do a film like Double Indemnity, even though I've seen it many times. But I think that we will get to some of the more overlooked films in there that people maybe haven't seen. So that is coming up next after we finally get through the silent films. We'll get to film noir, which brings us, Sam, to our poll questions. We want to get to these real quick. Last week, we asked you on the show at filmspotting.net, I like Adam Sandler in everything, just in comedies. It depends on the material or when he's not on screen. Sam, how did it come out?
Well, the vast majority, 69%, said depends on the material. And Adam, that's where you and I fell last week.
Mm-hmm.
18% said when he's not on the screen, that's when they like Adam Sandler most of all. 9% like him in everything, and only 4% said they just like him in comedies. So, but really, I think the vast majority, like we said, really depends on the material. And the fact is, that's probably a safe answer for most people. Depends on the material. But some people are devoted acolytes of Sandler, and I applaud their sympathy for the career.
Sure. Okay, this week's poll question, you can go and vote again at filmspotting.net. We're asking, on Friday, April 6th, that's next Friday, you will be
seeing Grindhouse Dummy, seeing Grindhouse with expectations it can't possibly match, dreading Rodriguez's half, ecstatic for Tarantino's, dreading Tarantino's half, ecstatic for Rodriguez's, seeing Ice Cube in Are We Done Yet, Dummy.
Well, it's tough because I want to go with simply seeing Grindhouse, Dummy, but
yeah.
I'll actually be seeing Grindhouse with expectations it can't possibly match.
So.
We already put it as the number one grand film of the spring, so I think there's a lot of hype going into it, but that is where I would probably vote right now. How about you?
Yeah, I think I would too, honestly. It's like the expectations are kind of through the roof. And because of the way I feel about Sin City, I maybe should say dreading Rodriguez's half, but I'm not entirely dreading it at all. But I think that'll help either have it not quite meet the expectations that are so high, or if it does, you know, if his is as solid as Tarantino's, then it may be possible that it matches my expectations.
Sure. All right, well, let's get on to this week's top five then. Again, career revivals, actors and actresses most in need of a career boost. And it doesn't really tie in with anything on this week's show. It happens to just relate to this month's issue of Premiere Magazine, if any of our listeners, if any of you out there have seen that. They have some actors, even like Cameron Diaz on there, some people who they think really are in need of help with their career, Nicole Kidman, people who are maybe on the downward trend right now. And we're going to get to some of our favorite actors who really we think should be in more movies or need to be in better movies. That's pretty much simply how it is. Sam, why don't you go ahead and get us started with your number five?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, it was tough because I just thought all of a sudden I was responsible for saving careers, like single-handedly, and there were just so many actors I wanted to save. And quickly, those that I could not save, Taya Leone, Thora Birch, Rupert Everett, Campbell Scott, and of course somebody like Daniel Day-Lewis, who I think sort of is doing his own thing. But those are all actors, certainly, I would like to see in more things than they deserve to be. I was at first concerned about Tim Roth and Gary Oldman, our old British character actor friends, and I looked at their future work, and it looks like they're going to be kept busy, and we're going to see some of them, which is good. My number five, though, is somebody I've always loved. I've always wanted to be in more films, and this is somebody who really should have the kind of career that Christopher Walken or John Malkovich has. He's an oddball who makes every movie he's in better and more watchable, and that's Jeff Goldblum. He you know, most recently, I think he's been given a shot as on a TV series on NBC, Rains, that looks like it's going to be canceled. And this is what I was referring to earlier. The actor that probably has the most memorable single line performance in maybe movie history in Annie Hall. What's my mantra?
Of course.
And I don't know, maybe I'm alone here, but I've always been obsessed with him. I've gone and looked at his like more obscure pictures, Mr. Frost. I don't know if anybody's seen that, a great lead performance with Goldblum playing the devil. But I love his old stuff, The Tall Guy I've mentioned before, The Fly. And it's just, it's not that Goldblum has gone completely out of our memory, but he is somebody that I just feel like isn't getting that kind of steady work that I know I'd certainly like to see. Put him in two or three premium pictures a year as a character actor. Give him a lead performance once a year. He deserves it.
A great choice by you. And I have a little theme running through all of my choices here, Sam. I managed to notice that as I was putting together my list, that all of my choices seemed to start, their last name seemed to start with the same letter.
Interesting.
And it was the letter K.
Okay.
So my top five is brought to you by the letter K. All five of my choices start with the letter K, and I'm starting with my number five, who by far is the only person I'm going to name who, by Hollywood standards, is having a great career. In fact, she may be having the best time in her career that she's ever had since winning an Oscar in 1977 for Annie Hall, and that's Diane Keaton.
Interesting.
My problem is I want to see Diane Keaton do a more serious role, something like she did in the 70s, a Looking for Mr. Goodbar, an Interior, some serious acting,
Reds
and not this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that she keeps making here with the Because I Said So and the Family Stone and Town and Country and Hanging Up. She just keeps making that same movie where she plays the older woman who still manages to be sexy and smart but totally neurotic. And I just want to see Diane Keaton do something dark and more interesting.
Wow, that is a great pick. I even considered it, but I'm like, oh no, you know what? She's keeping really busy. I should be happy with that. I should be satisfied. But you're right, I shouldn't be satisfied enough. I love Diane Keaton as much as you do, maybe even more. That's a good pick. All right, well, my number four, again, a name that's going to be familiar to people. I don't think you need to be reminded about Andy Garcia, but I don't know if you remember, like, certainly I know you, Adam, and I do, Andy Garcia's career in the late 80s, early 90s. He was totally leading man potential, not only coming out of Untouchables, but remember him being the only watchable thing in Godfather 3, like being completely electric, nominated for a Best Supporting Actor Oscar that year. Just totally unbelievable. His last five pictures, a little part in Smoke and Aces. He was on an episode of George Lopez. He wrote and directed and starred in The Lost City. Starred as Modigliani in Modigliani. Has anybody seen that? And then was in The Lazarus Child. Where is Andy Garcia? And of course, he is in these Oceans movies. I'm really happy to see that. But this guy is a great, great character actor. And I'm trying to think of who is being cast instead of Andy Garcia. And I couldn't quite come up with it. But Bruce Willis is hired so often. I think he's in like 12 or 14 pictures a year. Like, honestly, you could give Andy Garcia a couple of those slots, and he will fill him with aplomb.
Sure. Okay. A great choice. I didn't think about Andy Garcia, but I like it a lot, which brings us to my number four. And I've got my one tie here. This is my royalty list. Actors who basically are considered royalty and beloved. But really, if you look at what they've done lately, it's pretty darn bleak. And that is both Harvey Keitel and Ben Kingsley. You look at Harvey Keitel's list of movies lately. I mean, literally, if you go to IMDb and start listing his titles, I don't know that anyone listening to this show right now would recognize anything. The last thing I really can remember him in at all was 2002 in Red Dragon, playing Jack Crawford in a brief role. Otherwise, he really hasn't been in much of anything. And then you get to Ben Kingsley, who, yes, he had a nice turn in Oliver Twist as Fagin, Polanski's Oliver Twist, which we reviewed. He was in House of Sand and Fog in 2003. But then, otherwise, the most recent thing he's done that's notable at all, Lucky Number 11, which we both really disliked. Otherwise, you're looking at movies like Blood Rain, A Sound of Thunder, Suspect Zero, Thunderbirds, Tuck Everlasting. Really, what has happened to these great actors?
It's a good question. Honestly, Harvey Keitel had it so good in the early 90s. I mean, he was in a lot in the early 90s, a lot that I was seeing. And I almost feel like Harvey Keitel is either brilliant or is so bad it's funny. Like,
I agree completely.
I just don't know what to think about Keitel's career in general. So it's a good pick, but I agree with reservation. All right, my number three. This may be a surprise, but Jeff Bridges. He's not really gone anywhere, but last five pictures, Stick It, the gymnastics movie. Do you remember this, Adam? Seeing the trailers for this at all?
Oh, yeah.
And I was almost tempted to see it because Jeff Bridges was in it.
I know.
I really consider Jeff Bridges to be pantheon great actor of his generation. Seriously, put him in the same category as De Niro and Pacino. He's that good, and he hasn't had that many good roles. I mean, if, you know, on IMDb, I was looking at this, using this as kind of a measuring mark, the movie that comes up next to their name when you do a search for them, and it's The Big Lebowski, which, sure, that's great, but it's Jeff Bridges, and he's been doing a lot of kind of supporting work recently and nominated for The Contender a few years ago, but Jeff Bridges is somebody... and I wouldn't say this about everybody. When he's on screen, he's the one I want to watch. I want him to be the lead of the films he's in. I don't know if it's the choices he's making or the parts he's being offered, but Jeff Bridges needs to be in more and better films.
A fantastic choice. My number three is a guy I knew you would probably overlook. I don't know if you're really familiar with this guy all that much, but it's actually Elias Koteas.
Oh, yeah.
Who has a nice little role in the new movie Zodiac. And he plays a cop in that film in a small part again. And he's also in Shooter, the Mark Wahlberg movie that's out right now. So it's not like he's working. It's not like he's at least not getting good parts like he did in Zodiac, albeit a small one. But you look at the filmography again. Yes, you go back to the late 90s where he was in Living Out Loud and The Thin Red Line and Apt Pupil, which wasn't very good. And he's in Gattaca. But then after that, I'm going to list a few of these titles here, Sam. Harrison's Flowers, Lost Souls, Novocaine, Collateral Damage. I mean, it really is pretty ugly. Skinwalkers in 2006, The Big Empty in 2005. What has happened to Elias Koteas? For me, he will always be Duncan from Some Kind of Wonderful, one of the best small parts in that film, which, of course, Sam, means nothing to you, but he's hilarious as this kind of skinhead, you know, shaved head biker guy. He gets to play a tough guy, but I really like Elias Koteas a lot. And, of course, the other movie I think of him from, really, in addition to Some Kind of Wonderful, is Exotica, the Adam McGoyan film.
Yep.
He's the lead in that film, if I remember correctly, at least one of the main characters, and is really great in that film. So he's my number three.
Oh, I think it's a great pick. My number two, I like when there's a connection here. You mentioned Novocaine, a film I don't think either of us have seen. Also stars Laura Dern, which is number two on my list. And maybe unfair, because I don't think I would have thought of this unless I had seen her in Inland Empire, David Lynch's Inland Empire. She's brilliant in it. I think a lot of people will be reminded that Laura Dern is so good. Of course, we saw her in a small part in Year of the Dog as well, mm-hmm. at Sundance, which is sort of in limited release now, or coming into limited release soon. She's so good. And I'm only reminded of that by seeing Inland Empire. And I'm saying, when you're going to cast Julianne Moore or Laura Linney, and I know these are people I pick on a lot,
yes.
but cast Laura Dern every once in a while. I mean, most recently in Breach, I was saying, cast somebody else instead of Laura Linney. How good
That's
would Laura Dern have been in that small role? But she's somebody that, again, I think had a really, was a really kind of exciting career, late 80s, early 90s, nominated for an Oscar, Rambling Rose. I think that was 89 or 90. But really, since then, has just been getting work, and not the kind of work she deserves.
Okay, well, fantastic choice. I really feel bad about leaving Laura Dern off. And you're right, what a provocative point there, Sam. I'm already recasting the movie Breach with Laura Dern in that role, and now it's a 5-star movie.
That's right, it is.
I'm telling you. Okay, well, my number two, let's go ahead and hear a quick clip.
Molly?
What?
Could you come here a moment? I just want to... Oh. You are fat. You might think about cutting down on the desserts and the beer. And also possibly sex with men. When did this take place? Who did this to you?
That's the great Kevin Kline as Guy Noir in Robert Altman's A Prairie Home Companion. He was in that film in 2006. I know maybe Kevin Kline is a guy like his wife Phoebe Cates who has decided to be the family man and isn't really doing a lot of work. But you look before A Prairie Home Companion, here are his previous four films, Sam. The Pink Panther, De Lovely, The Emperor's Club, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame 2, which he has a voice in. He was also uncredited in Orange County and then Life is a House. I mean, really, it is a case where this guy, I think, in A Fish Called Wanda and in other films, certainly, he's great in The Ice Storm and Chaplin. Mm-hmm. He's such a brilliant actor and such a brilliant comedic actor. I was so glad to see him in A Prairie Home Companion. I think he made every scene he was in more interesting and funnier. And he does have a few more movies coming out this year that he's shooting right now. We'll see if those films are hopefully a little more interesting than the other films preceding A Prairie Home Companion, but one of those actors who I would love to see in everything and certainly in some better roles.
That's a really good pick. I was going through the list and I saw Kevin Kline come up. I'm like, that's going to be on Adam's list. I don't need to touch it. So it's a good one. My number one, and here's the wild card. I'm not even sure if this actor is interested in acting anymore. He hasn't done anything on film, I think, since the early 90s. But the fact is, he's still alive, unlike my wife thought when I mentioned this earlier this morning. Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
One of the greatest comedians of our time. He's 3 years older than Dustin Hoffman and should be cast at least as often as Dustin Hoffman is in his early 70s. I can't even believe that Gene Wilder is in his early mid-70s, but he is. And had one of the most remarkable comic records in the 70s, of course, working with Mel Brooks and then with Richard Pryor. And I know he had a really rough go of it, losing his wife, Gilda Radner, losing Pryor, a good friend. And I think he just seemed to have lost a lot of enthusiasm. But I was thinking of him in a movie like Stranger Than Fiction, that nice little role that Dustin Hoffman has.
Sure.
Can you imagine Gene Wilder in that part?
Inspired.
Oh, it's brilliant. It just made me excited to think about him. And again, it's very likely that Gene Wilder isn't interested in being any more movies, and I don't want to force him out of retirement, but if he is, more people need to cast him. He's just this piece of gold out there that I just feel like people need to take advantage of.
Sam, if this film critic thing doesn't work out for you, I think you need to become a casting agent.
That's right.
I don't know what the problem is. Someone needs to sign you up right now. Okay, well, my number one, let's hear another clip.
Oh, God. All right, we're out of here.
Gotta go, go, go.
Okay, where's my gun?
Give
me my gun.
Yeah, I threw it in the lake because I figured you wouldn't, I would. I got priors in New York, so I can't be messing around.
You threw it away?
Yeah, plus it's evidence.
You what?
Watch it.
Okay, Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got a little nonplussed there.
Okay, this is crazy. I understand. No, just relax.
Whoa, what is that? Is that a clue?
What do you mean?
Do you see that?
In the thing?
Ow! What were you thinking?
My $2,000 ceramic Vector my mother got me as a special gift, you threw in the lake next to the car. What happens when they drag the lake? You think they'll find my pistol?
That's Robert Downey Jr. with Val Kilmer in the recent film, the Shane Black film, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And Val Kilmer playing in that film a character named Gay Perry. Very good. I think you hear the banter there between him and Robert Downey Jr. Very funny stuff. He did get some attention for that. But this is a guy who early on in his career got that genius label because basically he was just really difficult to work with. In fact, right. Val Kilmer is, I think, the only guy we've mentioned so far, Sam, who's actually in the premiere article. And John Frankenheimer, who directed him in The Island of Dr. Moreau, said, "There are two things I will never do in my life. I will never climb Mount Everest, and I will never work with Val Kilmer again." So there you go. You can get a sense for how difficult this guy was to work with. But that's because there was some of that genius, I think, really there. Certainly watching him as Jim Morrison in The Doors is the only reason I would go back and watch that film again. I still have a soft spot for him from movies like Real Genius and Top Gun from my junior high years. But I think he really is. Thunderheart is another movie he's very good in. I think he is a great actor and really just needs more interesting parts that he can really sink his teeth into. I think he's really good even in Spartan, the David Mamet movie, that unfortunately I think is a lot like some of Mamet's recent films and doesn't work on the whole, but he's fun to watch as this special ops guy and get to play a badass a little bit. That's kind of fun to watch him in that role. But Val Kilmer, an actor I like, and I really would like to see him become a more regular kind of leading man again, or maybe even just be an interesting character actor from movie to movie.
Well, I think that's a great pick too. All right, well, that's our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message. You can also learn more about the movies and actors on our list by visiting the Film Spotting group page on PureFlix. The link is available at filmspotting.net.
Opening and wide release this weekend, Meet the Robinsons and the two movies we discussed earlier in the show, Blades of Glory and The Lookout. And if you have to choose, choose The Lookout.
That's right.
Next week, we expect to be reviewing the new Tarantino Rodriguez project, Grindhouse. But if for some reason, Sam, we aren't able to get to a screening early, check the calendar page at filmspotting.net for updates.
Thanks to Alex Nesnick and our message boards, Frank Huckle for his graphics help, and Dope Sheet editor Jeff Houston. Don't forget that you can sign up for the Dope Sheet, our weekly email blast at filmspotting.net. Thanks also to National Beekeepers Society for this week's music. Learn more at myspace.com/National Beekeepers Society.
Distributed through the Public Radio Exchange, Film Spotting is available for broadcast on your local public radio station. Information is available on our website, filmspotting.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.